Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
We used to run the economy with less money in credit. For every dollar of GDP, required substantially less money in credit. Now it just takes a lot. That can't be good for anybody. And I think gold's waking up and telling you that finally.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and we're going to have a very special update here. As you know, we've been doing quarterly updates with Adam Rosenzweig of Gehring and Rosenzweig. We're going to be talking about this. We're going to be talking about the return of inflation, shale oil's long goodbye with Adam. Hey, Adam, so good to see you again.
Great to see you, Chris. Nice to be talking to you again.
Likewise. So we're going to be discussing this, which every quarter, the quarterly reports out of your firm, Gehring and Rosenzweig, everybody should be reading this. Absolutely. This one came out in the August 25th issue here. 2025, the next inflationary surge is about to begin, but I think you buried the lead a little bit because you were talking about shale oil and all of that too. But I want to start here. You open this piece with, quote, "We are firmly in the camp that believes the great disinflationary arc, which began in the stern days of Paul Volcker's Fed, has run its course. The era of falling yields and fading price pressures is over. In its place, a new cycle has begun, an inflationary one, with the potential to stretch across decades. And if history is any indication, it will not pass quietly. It will bring with it the kind of problems that compound politically, economically, and socially until they can no longer be ignored." Let's start there with that great opening line. You have my attention, Adam. What brings you to that point?
So look, you know, if you guys have read our stuff, and I know you have, and some of your listeners and viewers have as well, you know that we believe that markets move in these big, long, drawn-out cycles. And we're in the midst of, you know, a doozy right now. And what I would sort of generalize it to is this bigger idea of a carry trade cycle, where there's certain times in the market where you have self-correcting feedback loop. So, for instance, value investing, that might be a good example that naturally takes care of itself. If value stocks do really well, they stop being value stocks and money migrates into another part of the market. So it naturally kind of goes in these ebbs and flows. There's other types of markets, though, that are feedback loops, positive feedback loops. Momentum would be one. If momentum stocks do well, then all of a sudden that begets more momentum because they become a larger and larger piece of the index by definition. And what works yesterday keeps working tomorrow. That's the definition of a momentum trade. And in markets like that, there's no regulator. There's nothing that kind of keeps things in check. So those just tend to accelerate and spiral and get worse and worse and worse until eventually they tend to end with more of a shock. And we're in one right now. It's been a disinflationary one. It's gone on for 45 years and counting. Let's call it 40 years in earnest. And it's created a huge amount of distortions, dislocations, mispricings, everything from the everything bubble of a few years ago to the hyperscalers to AI today to high duration, high multiple assets, low volatility, relatively low interest rates, except for the last sort of 18 months or so. And that's been allowed to persist because we've had very, very benign inflation, very, very benign volatility. But those things, I think, are now on the verge of ending. And if history's any guide, you know, President Trump has been, certainly hasn't hid his feelings towards Chairman Powell. And there's no shortage of newspaper articles that will talk about how that's really, really unprecedented. And maybe there's some truth to that. I don't know. Fed independence seems like it's not in its best days right now and under threat and things like that. But we can't forget that if we go back throughout history, there's been other unbelievably tumultuous times between the administration and the Federal Reserve, including, if you believe Amity Schley's book, The Great Society, there was a period of time where Lyndon Johnson actually took Chairman Martin, who, mind you, you know, you talk about an august reputation. I think he'd been the Fed chairman for like 20 years at that point or something crazy like that, and slammed him against a wall, physically assaulted him, and said, look, you know, my boys are in Vietnam dying and you won't give me the money that I need to help bring them home. And, you know, you can imagine that being a very sort of powerful conversation. Yeah. And if you put it in that context, I mean, my God, a couple tweets on Truth Social and things like that doesn't seem quite so bad anymore. Called him a loser or whatever he did. But that, you know, to my knowledge, no one has accused the president of having assaulted Chairman Powell. So we haven't hit a new low. Maybe we're probing it, but we haven't hit it yet in terms of the relationship between those two bodies. And, you know, I don't think it should be a huge surprise. That also took place. That huge consternation took place at the end of a big carry trade, the same as we have right now, where these distortions and these imbalances that fed on each other just got bigger and bigger until the system really couldn't handle it anymore. And the frustration, I think, you begin to see comes exactly from that. It's the idea that the imbalances are now so big that the system is having a hard time functioning, and it's difficult to run the country and run monetary policy. Why? Well, because we've printed so much debt in the last 20 years. We've printed, you know, had such big government deficits. We've printed so much money that the entire thing is becoming really, really imbalanced. And now it's beginning to break down. So if you talk to people that know Chairman Powell, and I don't think this is a big stretch, I think most central bankers fall into this category, they'll tell you that he's, you know, really wants to go down, you know, and on one side of his office, he has a big framed picture. I'm being facetious, but, you know, the proverbial big framed picture of Paul Volcker, who everyone thinks of as the best central banker that ever lived, broke the back of inflation, did the impossible. And then, you know, sort of also a little picture on the table, maybe of Arthur Burns, who's considered the worst Fed chairman ever, who, you know, was far too dovish in the face of inflationary pressures building and ended up, you know, causing or enabling the inflation through the 1970s. And so, you know, that's sort of the dichotomy, right? Don't be Arthur Burns, be Paul Volcker. But what nobody stopped to think about was that there was a third choice, which is you might be Martin. You might be the guy that tries really, really, really hard to keep the thing going and tries really hard to do the right thing, but ultimately succumbs to pressures, pushed aside, and allows for the Arthur Burns type to come in, who, by the way, I think gets sort of a bum rap. He wasn't as bad as everyone says, although he was under huge pressures and ultimately didn't emerge victorious, that's for sure. But he was a fairly smart guy. And, you know, a very smart macroeconomist said to me about a year ago, which has been sort of haunting me ever since, the idea that the path to Paul Volcker lies through Arthur Burns. You can't have Paul Volcker without Arthur Burns, because you can't take the medicine unless the pain of the inflation is so bad. And we just haven't had it yet. You know, we had a couple years where numbers were high and it was the shot across the bow. And then we raised interest rates, inflation sort of diminished a little bit, led largely by energy. But until you have that huge pain, you're never going to be able to stomach the contractionary monetary policies needed to truly rein in the inflationary expectations. And that's what people just don't get. We have to have that in order to get the catharsis that's going to come likely later. So if you look in the 1970s, there was the same. You had a run-up of inflation. You had some tightened monetary policy. You had a recession. Everything came back. You waved the all clear. That's when Burns came in, waved the all clear. And then, you know, the second half is when the fireworks took place and the inflation really got going. And I think that's going to be very similar to what we're going to see this time as well.
I have a chart on that. But first, you know, they famously say they never ring a bell at tops, but sometimes they print a cover at the bottoms. You pointed this out. I mean, what great near perfect timing. Is inflation dead with a crumpled up dinosaur there? Bloomberg picking the bottom for that inflationary moment almost perfectly.
Well, what's so interesting is, you know, when that Bloomberg cover story was released in May of 2019, a couple things happened. First of all, you know, there's only a few of us that really even picked up on that cover and posted it. We did at the time. You go back and look at our Twitter. It was us and Jim Grant and maybe one or two others. And then we wrote about it a little bit more extensively in our next letter, and we said 2022 is going to be the time that inflation really picks up its head, which that was 2019. That was pre-COVID, you know, so you weren't anywhere near, and people said, well, why did you think that? And they said, well, you know, if you go back to 1978 or early 79, Bloomberg, which was then just Business Week, ran a cover story called The Death of Equities, which is sort of heralded as the worst piece of financial prognostication in the history of the world, because equities were about to go on a 40-year run unlike anything has ever been seen before. You know, you were able to, in 1980, you were able to buy the Dow at 800. It's 40,000, you know, today. So we're in excess of 40,000 today. So Lee said very perniciously that 3 years after that cover story happened, that's when equities really took off in 81. And so it'll be 3 years after 2019 that inflation will really start to take off. So it's 2022. So we just got off a big call with somebody, a prospective client a minute ago. And we said, you know, as part of this business is a little bit of art and a little bit of science. So there's the example of the art. You know, why 3 years? I don't know. It's 3 years last time. Magazine indicators usually don't quite get the bottom, just quite, but they're awfully close. 3 years, mm-hmm. fine. And that's exactly what happened. And as an aside, I read a article with the guy who wrote the Death of Equities piece, and God bless him. He said, you know, for the next 2 years, equities went down a lot. And if you had traded my signal, you would have made a good return. I said, yeah, I think you're missing the forest for the trees there a little bit. But
markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. Let's talk about, I want to get into inflation because this could mirror the 70s again, but let's just start to parse it a little bit, because inflation, everybody listening to this thinks of that instantly, automatically as rising prices. Okay, so let's look at prices very quickly. This headline just popped up just literally an hour ago, and it says sticker shock, car prices top $50,000 for the first time in U.S. So I think that's probably average car prices, could be median. I didn't read the article yet. But then we're looking over here at the Fred data. This is the bad old 1970s that we're comparing ourselves to, but the slope of this line is actually steeper for this little mm-hmm. chunk here. Post-COVID injection, the stimmy checks, all of that. This is actually one of the more sustained and awful periods of inflation. And I would think that the Federal Reserve, whoever's at charge, Powell's got to be cognizant of this. He does not want to go down as a Burns, I would think, at this point, because that's, I don't look at that chart, Adam, and I say I see a case for easing here that's very strong.
Yeah, listen, you know, I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, if you take a step back, the tension that you feel in the central bankers' decisions today, I think largely stems from the fact that one way or another, the United States is approaching a level of debt and deficit that is really unsustainable. And look, people have said that for a very, very, very long time. But there's a difference between unsustainable and a crisis. And I think we're approaching that level fairly quickly. And so I think that puts a lot of tension in these two mandates, these two aims, because you, on the one hand, you look at the inflation data, which does seem to be a lot more persistent than anyone would care to admit. And on the other hand, you know, you really can't handle higher interest rates in terms of the government's ability to fund itself. And so let's like take a step back and say what I'm talking about there. You know, so if you look and this goes all the way back to Yellen, but it's happening today under Treasury Secretary Bessent as well. In fact, it's accelerated. If you go back, you know, when we crossed 100% debt to GDP, people became fixated on the idea that your 10-year Treasury rate could not exceed long-term growth rate. Otherwise, you'd be in a debt spiral, right? You're literally, if you're only whatever 20% debt to GDP, your interest rates could be really high and you can withstand it. If your debt level is the same as the economy and the interest is a percent on that level is higher than your economy is growing, then by definition, even if everything's going great, you're going to get yourself worse and worse into debt just on the additional interest expense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's become this huge fixation on that price level. And sure enough, you know, all the way back when Yellen was Treasury Secretary, when you started to approach 5% on the 10-year, she stopped issuing bills because of, or bonds because of it. You know, she just stopped issuing the 10-year, and she started to move into a shorter and shorter and shorter duration in order to try to relieve some pressure on the 10-year. And that's when you got the inverted yield curves and everything like that. And so what that ended up happening at that point, you know, you went into 30, 60, 90 day bills. Now, a couple things. First of all, we're very sensitive to changes in interest rates because of that. Very, very, very sensitive because we have to refinance our debt stack that much faster. And second of all, you've actually sucked out a huge amount of liquidity from the system inadvertently. And this is because of what's known as the relative value hedge fund trade. And God, you know, always beware if a commodity guy is talking about macroeconomics and financial plumbing, but I think this is really important. So what happened is you have a different kind of buyer in the bills market than you did in the bonds market. The bonds market is asset management companies, long-term liability holders, foreign and domestic central banks. And in the bill market, it's money market funds. And so the only problem with money market funds is that they don't buy treasury bills. They buy treasury bill futures. And it's just easier for them. It's easier for them to clear and settle in custody. And so what you end up with is a hedge fund who sits in the middle, who takes like a, you know, 2 basis point spread or probably even less than that, and buys the treasury bill and sells the futures or the forward to the money market fund. And of course, that's not so exciting. I mean, it's a pretty riskless trade. You know, you buy a treasury bill and you sell a treasury bill future. It's pretty straightforward, but it requires an awful lot of leverage because it's not very exciting on its own. And so you lever that up 50, 100 times to one, whatever it's going to be. And that's what's known as this relative value trade. And total quintessential carry trade, by the way. I mean, almost the definition of a carry trade. Cheap bank financing, take a tiny little risk-free spread and magnify it. Now, the issue with that is that it's sucked up so much liquidity that there's about $1 trillion of leverage being lent into this trade right now, right? So these are big dollars. That liquidity is available into the market when you're issuing bonds because that trade collapses. But when all of a sudden you move your bonds to your bills, you have now sucked up $1 trillion of liquidity. So you're in a real tough spot because you need more liquidity on the one hand. You have inflation on the other hand. You can't issue bonds again because then everyone's going to know that you're basically bankrupt. So you're really boxed in. And this, I think, just falls under the idea of, you know, I go bankrupt slowly at first and then all at once. You know, we're in a tough spot. This is why we're in a moment, I think, of realignment and a moment of needing to change the big kind of large superstructure that exists over the monetary system and the financial plumbing. I think gold's telling you some version of that. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I don't know that it ends badly for the United States. We've been in tough spots before. And in 1969-70, it looked like we were going to run out of gold. We ended up finally breaking the whole world's exchange standard, Bretton Woods, and shut the gold window. And what did that do to the dollar? It made it super relevant, more relevant by 1985, 1990 than it was in 1965. So, I mean, kind of bizarre things like that. The U.S. still has a huge amount of might and dynamism, but it has a big debt problem. So I think people are trying to find solutions to that. I think it's going to lead to inflation for sure. I think you're in this moment now where the carry trade unwinds and you start to see tomorrow doesn't look the same like as yesterday. And that's really bad for a carry trade and really good for real assets and gold.
Well, we'll get to gold in a minute because, wow, what a story there. But this has huge implications, obviously, for everybody who's trying to plan for retirement or think about how they have to diversify or how they're going to spread the risk. I want to get to this idea, though. You said this is going to create problems that are going to compound politically, economically, and socially, which brings me to this idea here, which I call this the what the heck, let's elect Mom Dami in your city. Why not? What could possibly go wrong chart? Sven Henrik pointed this out, that net worth of the top 0.1%, that's only 135,000 households, versus in the red dotted line, versus the net worth in the bottom 50%, that's 67 million households. Obviously, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times as much wealth contained in the top households. So this is really what we're talking about here, is ever since that great financial crisis, which would be right here at my cursor in that gray spot right here, the Fed has done everything it can to liquefy and print and financialize. And it's really, can we be honest about this, flowed highly preferentially to one segment of society, not to the bulk of it. It has consequences, social consequences, does it not?
Oh, I think it certainly does. I mean, I think the administration today, populist left and populist right, are a reaction to that for sure. I mean, look, you know, I'm certainly not the only person that said it, far from it, and you've read it time and time again, but very clearly what you have seen is wealth creation through asset price inflation, and that in and of itself is neither good nor bad, but it obviously does redistribute wealth a little bit in the sense that if you don't own assets, then you don't have assets that appreciate. Now, the issue is that at the same time as that's been happening, other things like, you know, real wages and things have largely stagnated, so you have had a big growing gap. And I'm certainly no bleeding heart, and I'm not even liberal. I'm quite conservative. But, you know, I mean, yeah, you can't deny that the actions of the Federal Reserve over the last 15 years has led to a huge amount of wealth inequality because of asset prices have skyrocketed to the point where major cities are sort of unlivable for most people, unless, you know, you fall into one or two or three very specific categories. If you're in the real estate business, you have to be something that's carry trade or carry trade adjacent. If you're in the real estate business, it's been really good. If you push paper across your desk in some form of financial trading or financial services, you've been able to take advantage of that, even if you don't own the assets. You know, there's young finance guys that do quite well, and ladies that do quite well without necessarily owning assets, because they have, you know, they're adjacent to that industry. But other than that, I mean, yeah, the real economy, wage growth has largely stagnated, and it makes for quite a bit of animosity and jealousy amongst the classes, for sure.
Yeah, I only wanted to raise that because I wanted to, you mentioned how the Fed's boxed in, but I believe they are increasingly socially boxed in, politically boxed in, and now sort of monetarily or economically boxed in. It's getting dicey.
Yeah, so, look, you know, I mean,
I don't know what I would do if in their position, to be honest. I've thought about it long and hard, like, what would I do? I'm a big critic, but I don't know what I would do.
It's tricky, right? And this, everyone is sort of, everyone has identified the same risks to this type of a system. And the risks is, they're kind of the risk of incrementalism a little bit, is that you can get away with it for a while and doesn't really hurt anybody or anything. And, you know, you can have elasticity of your money supply. You know, we could go back to a gold standard and be extremely rigid and go through periods of deflations and busts. And I probably think that we would be better off for it. We'd allocate capital more prudently. We probably would have longer term growth for everybody, right? Rich and poor alike would do better, because you'd have a cost of money, you'd have a cost on interest that reflects the scarcity of that asset, and you'd put it into the right projects, and you wouldn't squander it on stupid things like solar panels in Germany where there's no sun and things of that nature. And, you know, because of that, it might not happen on day one, but because of that, that would certainly trickle down to everybody in the form of higher growth and higher prosperity. Instead, we've taken a different route. And the reason is, you know, it's politically intolerable to go through a big recession that could be alleviated with a Fed backstop. So you do it once, you do it twice, you do it three times, and you never bring it back to neutral. You know, so after the GFC, I've spoken to so many people who worked at the Fed during the GFC, and they all say the same thing, which is, I don't fault anyone for doing what they did. I don't fault Ben Bernanke for doing what he did in the depths of the GFC, but I fault him terribly for not pulling back some of that liquidity shortly after. You know, it became permanent. So now we run our economy with a balance sheet that's as a percent of GDP, massive, massive. We used to run the economy with less money and credit. For every dollar of GDP required substantially less money and credit. Now it just takes a lot. That can't be good for anybody. And I think gold's waking up and telling you that finally.
Well, it is, and I'll get to that in a minute. But so the case, though, so, are, you know, are we at the Burns era, McMartin? But here's Powell or whoever comes next. And obviously, inflation has not come down. So the Fed has this 2% target, which is laughable because we haven't been there for like 54 months, right? Or whatever it is now. I haven't added it up lately, maybe 55. But I look at this, and so ultimately, inflation, you can pretty much understand it through M2, a broad measure of money that's in the system. And here we can see, obviously, there was this massive COVID gyration, disruption, perturbation. But I'm looking at this, Adam, and I see a year-over-year growth in M2 of 5%, and I'm not seeing tight conditions here. This is kind of it's kind of headed up, and if I'm going to be honest, that's kind of an awkward spot for the Fed to say, yeah, let's make the case for more easing here. Although, honestly, when the Fed sets interest rates today, it's not like it was at any point before Bernanke in 2008, because now they just turn a dial and they change the interest on excess reserves, and it happens. They don't withdraw money and put cash back in the system, as far as I understand anymore. So, but money growth itself in the system looks reasonable to me by historical standards.
No, listen, I think it is. I think part of the issue, though, with liquidity and liquidity metrics in the system right now is all that money that's tied up in these crazy cockamamie things like, you know, $1 trillion, right? I mean, that's a big part of M2, you know, that just is no longer available for use. It's doing nothing. Mm-hmm. It's not dissimilar from when you had all those excess reserves after the GFC. And so you had to sort of adjust your monetary base because you have this big M2 number, but a trillion of it is doing seriously nothing. It's providing a 2 basis point liquidity advantage to 6 hedge funds around the world who do nothing but buy a treasury bill and sell a treasury bill future. I mean, there's not going to be much of a multiplier on that money, right? I mean, that's a crazy amount of liquidity to be tied up in something. And there's like 2 or 3 other examples of crazy distortions that are like that. So look, as far as the liquidity situation goes, you know, it's very, very, very tough to say. But the inflationary pressures that feel like they're bubbling up certainly, I think, are at the risk of accelerating, predominantly because we're having a good year this year, to say the least. People can go and look at our website if they want to learn more. But that's really on the back of precious metals and uranium, which is a fairly obscure commodity rallying at least based in the broad market. You know, I think the index has about 1% uranium, and then it's gold, right? But energy has actually been fairly lackluster this year, and the risk is massively to the upside on energy, both in terms of natural gas and crude oil. And so that certainly does not help inflationary numbers as well. And you have to remember, the thing about inflation that makes it so difficult to model, is that inflationary expectations are not an exogenous shock. Inflationary expectations become embedded in the economy and they distort behavior, which actually then changes the rate of inflation going forward. That might sound like a convoluted thing to say, but I mean, just think about it like this, right? When people begin to feel inflationary pressures coming, they pull forward their purchases, which puts a strain on the supply chain, which causes retailers to raise their price and actually creates the inflation that everybody was worried about in the first place. What do you think that does to inflationary expectations? You know, then it becomes a bit of a cycle. And that's super hard to model. No one has it in their models. I don't know if that's why people missed the last quote unquote transitory inflation period. But, you know, it's tricky because it's half macroeconomics and it's half psychology. And to me, neither look particularly dovish. Both seem like they're going to lead to higher inflation in the next 3 to 5 to 7 years.
Well, I want to talk about, I know I haven't heard the phrase in a while, but Bernanke was all about anchoring inflation expectations. And they're very unanchored apparently right now in Japan. Last thing I saw, people are expecting like 10% inflation. So whether that comes true or not, as you just said, that reflexivity of because they expect it, they'll probably get it, and then they'll get more of it, and then they'll expect more of it, and that has to run its course, right? But I came across this, and I really wanted to talk about this with you, which is, history rhymes often, and at Apollo Research, Torsten Slok, the economist, said, whoa, this is kind of looking a lot like the 70s again. So we had our first inflation mountain here, which had its set of uses. You were just talking about the decisions the Fed was making right around here. Mm-hmm. And then we had the second inflation mountain, which in a couple of reasons, right? We had an energy shock in there. We had the Vietnam War monetary shock. We had a variety of things. But I want to talk about, if this comes to pass, will history will rhyme? And I think there's a lot of reasons. You mentioned one of them, because we have to get to the upside potential of oil contributing almost verbatim to this particular chart again, in essence, right? A very rhyming sort of a period of time.
Oh, absolutely. Gosh, there's so many parallels to the 1970s. And we, I mean, lots of people have shown this chart, but we showed this chart as well. We put this in one of our letters maybe a year or so ago. It obviously didn't go as far, but it is continuing to follow that exact same trend, you know, eerily well. And like you said, it might have some similarities in terms of the root underlying causes as well, in terms of, you know, a big energy shock that nobody expected. And I don't know, can you pull that chart up again?
Yeah.
The other thing that's so fascinating is that if you look right as the core CPI and the 1974-82 experience, no, right when it bottomed. So, you know, that corresponded exactly to when U.S. conventional crude oil production peaked and rolled over. And that was something that took everyone by surprise. Everyone, you know, remember, if you will, when from the day we first drilled oil, you know, oil was discovered at kind of at the same time in the U.S. and in Azerbaijan. The U.S. went on a run from 1890 to 1971. Almost, you know, huge swings in the price, but you had young growing fields, and so you were able to withstand that, and production just grew and grew and grew. And then in 55, this guy King Hubbert predicts that by 71, U.S. oil production is going to roll over, and sure enough, it does. It caught everybody off guard. It caught everyone off guard so much, I think we might have talked about this last time, that Nixon got on TV and launched Project Independence, where he said, look, you know, we've come to take our energy industry for granted. We haven't, you know, dedicated enough time, resources, education, whatever, into generating the next generation of oil field services and drillers and whatever. And so we're going to help raise prices, give them a big tailwind. We're going to make taxes less burdensome, make regulation less burdensome, and the industry is going to get back to work. And it's called Project Independence. And production fell another 30% over the next, you know, three decades after he announced that. And today, right around that time, or right around the same time in that troughing period, we had the shales, the big source of growth, now begin to roll over and begin to falter. And the timing's not exactly right, because, you know, we're going to peak U.S. shale production in 2000, realistically on a monthly basis in late 24. So it's a couple years after, but gosh, it's awfully close. And frankly, from 2019-20, which is the low in the inflation number there, which corresponds to 72, you've had very, very meager growth. You had the huge COVID slowdown in oil and gas, and then it came back and made a new high, but not by too much. Nothing like the growth we had before. And so I think it's going to be the same driver. The main source of non-OPEC oil supply growth is now slowing and rolling over. Doesn't mean it goes to zero. Didn't go to zero in the U.S. Still a very robust business through the 80s and 90s. Played lots of people. I think the same will be true here. But it's not going to be the incremental barrel of growth that the world needs. And I think that's very important.
I'm going to dive into that. But just I want to just clean up one little piece that we said we were going to talk about, just to make sure we're clear about this. So you had a really great point in the quarterly report. You said, you know, things get a little out of favor. Do you remember this? I remember this because I was here. This is when gold in blue, nobody wanted it, like coming in here through, you know, 1999 into 2000. And gold in terms of a global reserve, it has no role in monetary policy anymore. It's the barbarous relic and all that stuff. It has nothing to do with nothing. And here it's gone from, well, I guess that's 10% over 20%. So this is big, because this is global dollar reserves, in essence, and the dollar's coming down, and you can see what's happening here. This is an extraordinary change, but nobody saw this coming back here. Well, except you did, right?
Well, I didn't. I have to give Lee credit. Lee did.
Give Lee credit for that. By the way, this is where I first started buying gold heavy, right? Right there, 2021. That was, 2001. That was my moment.
Good for you. Well,
That's because the Fed was printing like $5 billion a month. You know, I got to hold my pinky up. That was like such quaint numbers by today's standards.
Totally. No, you know, look, nobody saw that coming, and what, and you know, we'll probably never see that again, right? By the late 1990s, gold had become so out of favor that you could really make the case that you didn't need a gold mining industry. Like we always say all the time, we knew it was unsustainably low when the price of an ounce, price of an ounce of gold was less than the cost to extract it in the best mines in the world on that same ounce. So the mining industry couldn't make a cash margin. So it said, do you want a gold mining industry? Well, playing devil's advocate, you could argue you didn't need a gold mining industry because all the central banks were in the process of liquidating. They were your gold mining industry, right? And they came together and devised a scheme to not front run each other and get rid of all their gold, and they would be net sellers. It was expected for 30 to 35 years, like massive, you know, generations. They would be just pressing down the price. And so why on earth would you want to own it when you could own bonds? You know, that was obviously
exciting bonds,
the most favorite asset class. And so, you know, that created a unbelievable bearishness in the market that probably would be difficult to replicate without a huge forced seller the same way like you did then. But it was a great time. The whole narrative was complete bunk. It was a great time to get involved in gold. Gold went on to be the best performing asset class, not only of the decade, but then it took a bit of a breather, but still on a 25-year basis, it's the best performing asset class of the last quarter century. This was the barbarous relic that everyone told you 99 had no role to play. And so, yeah, you know, I think it's being remonetized. I actually don't really think it ever stopped being money, but I think we just stopped thinking of it as money. You know, you obviously have a different, massive difference in who's buying now. You know, the central banks are buying, but it's not those same central banks that sold their gold. It's not England and Switzerland. It's really China that's buying a lot of that, and the other BRICS countries, Brazil, India, and China. Russia is, you know, needs as much liquidity as they can get, so they're probably not big gold buyers, but on the margin. And Poland is a big gold buyer, and so but you're not seeing, you know, the Western central banks coming back, so you're broadening gold's, interestingly enough. You're not, you know, the countries that used to use gold to back their currencies, they're seeing more coverage now because the price is going up, but they're not accumulating. But you're seeing a broadening of the acceptance of that kind of a regime to other countries that didn't have big gold reserves before. And so, you know, it's been absolutely fascinating. And I think it partially explains, obviously, why gold is making all-time highs at $4,000, more than partially. What's been interesting is that the Western investors haven't really returned to the gold market. We've seen a little bit of an uptick in holdings through the GLD, but not through the gold equities. And people say, well, does that matter? I mean, yeah, a true gold robust speculative mania. If I told you you could get a 6x levered bet on gold by owning a gold equity, you know, those things are going to do super well. You know, the Tesla 3x longs ETF, single stock ETFs do really well. And, you know, when you get to that part of the market, gold equities will do well also, but you don't even need to put on the financial leverage. But, you know, you're not there yet. So the price action so far has been mostly the central banks buying, and it's been just recently a little bit of Western interest coming back into bullion only. So I think we have a long way to go. You know, the only thing that gold seems awfully expensive relative to, not relative to all the debt that's out there, all the GDP that's out there, nominal dollars or anything like that. Certainly, you know, I had a meeting with Pierre Lassonde last week, and he was talking all about, you know, the gold to Dow ratio, which gets crossed one in the past. So that would be, you know, 46,000 on gold or whatever, you know, 23,000 if gold fell, if the Dow fell by 50% and the huge market correction. I don't know. But, you know, it doesn't seem expensive in those terms, but it is awfully expensive relative to crude. In fact, it's at a record. The only time it's been cheaper relative to crude has been during COVID, when oil went negative. Yeah, 65 barrels of oil with 1 ounce of gold.
65. Unbelievable. Yeah. 7.5 standard deviations above its long-term trend. For the math wonks at home, that's a very rare event.
Yeah. It's not supposed to happen.
No. No, but I mean, all the way since 1970, you know, it bounced along here, and this would just be one standard deviation away, right? So it just bounced basically within one standard deviation. Up and down from 1970. Yeah. Okay, COVID, this is weird. We had negative oil for a couple of days there. But outside of that, this is a fairly sustained and very robust move right now.
Totally. And the thing that's really bizarre in the oil markets today is that, you know, I would argue that crude prices today reflect capitulation lows. And you know, certainly relative to gold, it's at a level that only happened during COVID. In real dollars, it's awfully cheap as well. And you look at the headlines, the IEA is now talking about, even in the second half of this year, a surplus in the crude markets that rivals that we saw during COVID. Remember, we like shut down the world's transportation and tank batteries were overflowing and people were paying negative prices for someone to take oil off your hands so that they could shut in wells, etc. And according to the IEA, this year, and certainly the second half of this year, of which we are now halfway through the second half of this year, the surplus today is nominally on paper worse than it was during COVID. What doesn't seem worse? We don't see inventories going up. Actually, until yesterday, oil remained backwardated, which meant that traders were willing to pay a physical premium for prompt delivery because inventories were quite low. So you have pricing that suggests it's the worst days that we've ever seen. You have an energy agency that's out there telling you it's as bad as it's ever been before. And that, I think, is propagating the fear and what have you. And yet, when you look at the actual fundamentals, which, I mean, you don't have to be so sophisticated to read an inventory number, you'll see that it's not going up. It's not going up. When you look at the IEA, interestingly, they did put out a report, which I think is probably their most insightful report in some time, which said that next year, you know, they look at how much the base is declining and how much an ongoing capital investment is needed in order to just hold production flat or grow. And we're just at the level basically to hold it flat, according to them, to say nothing of growth. And so I don't see that being a situation where we're going to be able to have such a loose market at all. In fact, we might have quite a tight market, and yet you're getting this capitulation low pricing. So maybe everyone sees something that I don't see. I'm not really sure what that would be. The shales have now pretty definitively rolled over. They rolled over last October, oil. Everyone asks me when they'll roll over year on year. I suspect by this October.
So let me just throw in a quick point, because I want to get into the shales big time, but you're not alone. It turns out that at the recent Energy Intelligence Forum conference in London, just happened a couple days ago, the ExxonMobil CEO, I think he knows something about the oil business, I'm guessing, and says that Darren Woods says that today's oil glut, such as it is, which may be a fiction, is short term, and that without new investment, supply could fall 15% per year. Now, is he talking his book, or is he seeing something that maybe the IEA has missed here?
That's interesting. I mean, I suspect if you parse that number and you really dove into what he's talking about, I mean, that's high. That is not the base decline rate. Something would have to go fundamentally catastrophic, frankly. We would have massive, massive issues. You know, if you move from a 4%, which is a good guess for the base decline rate, to 5%, that's the difference between a really strong bull market and kind of a neutral market. 15%, I mean, that would be, you know, almost catastrophic. So I suspect he's looking maybe at his shale assets or shale in general. Those things could be true if you look at a younger, more high decline basin. But yeah, look, you know, you're on a treadmill. The oil business is always a treadmill. I mean, all the extractive industries are. You know, you produce something and then it begins to decline the minute it comes online. So you have to invest more and invest more and invest more. And the problem is, and this is what actually kind of creates the commodity cycles, when the market's in surplus, prices collapse to find the level that'll shut off the next unit of supply, which is really low. So you're not incentivizing anyone to invest in the next generation of projects. So you the base starts to decline. In the first year, you still might be in a surplus. It might take 2 years. And then everyone says, well, you know, prices will stay low forever, but they don't. They slowly ratchet tighter until you slip back into a deficit. And it's the fact that not everything happens overnight and that you don't have the instant gratification of new projects coming online and depletion taking hold, and that creates the cycle, because the timing signals aren't perfect. You know, it takes time on both sides. So that's always been true. And now you're at a level of capital investment where you're not able to sustain that anymore. I mean, it's as simple as that. And you can measure these things. Lots of people do, fewer and fewer, but you can measure where we are in the capital cycle. And that's pointing for a very, very, very bullish 5 to 10 year run for energy. Now, does it happen at the end of this quarter? I think it could. Is it next year? It's possible. But when you're buying an ounce of gold and you're able to buy 65 barrels of oil with it, I think you'll be very happy. Chris, to put it in perspective, when you bought your ounce of gold back in the late 1990s, the same ounce bought 6 barrels of crude. So you would have been very wise to drain the swimming pool that I know is in your backyard that was full of crude at the time and sell it for gold. And today probably makes sense to buy some oil. I'm not saying that gold won't do well. In fact, we remain quite bullish on gold, but clearly oil is the mispriced asset between those two. Seven standard deviations is telling you something is either really badly mispriced or there's a huge turn coming that I don't see.
Well, I want to get into that because this is the crux of it. And of course, you and I have been talking about the shale thesis for a while and the depletion paradox and all of that. This is a section in your most recent quarterly report, The Arithmetic of Depletion, Shale's Long Goodbye. The age of shale is drawing to a close. Big statement. I just want to start with this, though. This is the price of crude oil, WTI. Obviously, just sustained awfulness. It starts at 85 and goes down to 58 as of this morning. That's just a big, long, slow goodbye to the price of oil. I guess we don't need oil anymore. But you wrote in here, this is fascinating. So many things. There's a couple things in here that really caught me. And I read oil as carefully as I can. So kudos. You got some stuff in here that I was like, ooh, great point. We'll start here. You said, quote, with hindsight, the record is plain enough. Shale oil production crested November of 2024 at 9.19 million barrels a day. Has since slipped by a modest 180,000 barrels per day. In a year-on-year basis, growth has slowed from 800,000 barrels a day as recently as 23 to just 80,000 barrels per day, and destined to turn negative by October. And you debated Doomberg about all this, and I have too. But this seems pretty clear to me. I see a trend, and you don't have to be an expert chart reader to see that trend, do you?
No, I don't think so. Well, I mean, I find that the funniest thing here is that on a monthly basis, you peaked in October of last year, and you've not regained that high. You peaked in October. That was the high. I guess that's what it means, right, by definition. Mm-hmm. And I still get a lot of people saying, well, that's all well and good, but when do you think it's going to decline year on year? And I said, well, I suspect it'll be by this October. And they said, that soon? Why would you say that? And I said, well, if last October was the peak and you're comparing it to a year ago and this October is not higher, then you're going to be down year on year. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe that's going to be the catalyst that's going to get people to realize it. You know, I would have thought that the sequential change, there can be noise, right? Monthly changes can be difficult because you can get another rebound. So I get it. But you're a couple months in, nothing. 6 months in, nothing. Now you're 11 months in. Doesn't look like we're going to get a new high. We could. You know, a new pad could come on, or three pads instead of two, and pulls a little production forward. But I think that it will be negative pretty soon. And is that this thing that gets people going? I'm not sure. Is it when inventories finally start to decline? Because I will admit, you know, oil markets have been basically balanced for the last 18 months, 2 years. You know, for those out there that say the market is in surplus, I think that's nonsense. But it's equally nonsense to say the market's in sharp deficit. The market's been balanced with a price signal that's telling you on a balanced market, I would be buying it, right? You know, the odds are in your favor. So maybe it's when the market finally slips into deficit and inventories fall, or maybe it requires like a real crisis. I'm not sure. But I think we're moving towards that day by day.
Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. Well, I was just shocked that this came out in April. This is the EIA, not the IEA. EIA, very similar, but this is the Energy Information Administration. So for the U.S., but this did shock me because 2024, this dotted blue line of production output in shale went out flat to 2050, and then they very quietly said, "Yeah, no, that's a peak." I would have thought, well, for me, this is a very obvious thing that happened. All of a sudden, this is big news, right? That's big news. The EIA itself, ultra bullish, with I would suggest even potentially some political pressure at this point to be as bullish on production as possible, still came out and said, oh yeah, this is adding up to look a little bit more like what you've been projecting for a while now.
No, listen, I think the writing's on the wall, okay? These are really, really big assets. They've been depleting and declining slowly at first and then more and more and more. It's all about differential equations. You know, you're constantly drilling new wells and you have old ones depleting. And at some point, the production from the new ones isn't enough to overtake the depletion from the old ones. And when you look at it on balance, it's this nice kind of steady number, but it's a little bit like ducks under the water. It's frenetic activity happening all the time. And small changes have a big amplified impact on the output. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're now entering this period where the shales are all sort of mature assets and you don't get the same levels of growth from them that you did before, or the ability to grow even if you wanted to pull on them and press a little bit harder. And so what does that look like? You know, in the last, 15 years, you brought on 10 to 13 million barrels, whether you're taking your NGLs or not, of crude oil production and 90 billion cubic feet of natural gas. Divide that by six, you know, divide it by 10 and you'd be at nine. So you're at what, 15 million barrels there. You brought on nearly 30 million barrels of oil equivalent in this country. And nobody thinks that the last 15 years had anything to do with energy. I mean, that's really a testament to the dynamism of the U.S. economy. When they talk about the 2010s, they don't talk about the energy boom. When you talk about Saudi Arabia in the 50s, I promise you they talk about oil. But when they talk here, it's just sort of something that happened in the background. And so I kind of maybe forgive people for becoming somewhat complacent or, you know, just forgetting that you actually need to care and tend to this industry. But you do. And so now it's come, the chickens, no pun intended, to Doomburg are coming home to roost, and we're starting to see tightness overall. And that's going to be a problem. There's no way around it. It's a simple story, and there's going to be a problem.
I agree. And to get there, I would like everybody to be aware that when we talk about the shales, U.S. shales, we're actually really talking about the Permian Basin only at this point in time, because this gray line in your report is all other shales combined, actually down from its peak back here. And the story is 100% the Permian. And as we covered last time, it's actually the story of four counties in Texas and New Mexico at this point. We're literally down to named counties as being responsible for keeping the whole thing going in terms of narrative control.
And if you were to look at the acreage maps in those four counties, I mean, maybe that's what it takes. It takes a real aha moment if you look at everything that's been drilled. You know, are there little pockets? There's a couple. But I'm talking like a couple, you know, when we look at the royalty side of the business, too. So we get shown packages all the time. And if you want something that's undrilled, it's not going to be in Midland, Martin, Loving, Reeves County. It's going to be, you know, in second tier areas. These things have been drilled like pincushions. And that's what brought on that unbelievable period of prosperity in the United States and in the world, frankly, resulted in low oil prices, allowed the debt bubble to go on longer than it could otherwise because there was no inflationary pressures.
Helped the trade deficit.
But it's all ending. And so there's a problem. And so people need to have a little bit of protection in something that's not in that everything else portfolio, because everything else has this common factor in it. Everything else has become the carry trade, and you need something. Gold has been the first thing that has sort of proved itself. The rest is still hypothetical, right? To own oil stocks is still, you have to believe me a little bit. Gold's showing you what that looks like, where you can start to really create wealth. And then what's going to be really scary is likely, based on valuations in the broad market and certain trends on the investment side, and talk about AI if you want, we're going to go through a period where it's not that you can do better in gold than you can in the S&P, but that's the only place where you will be able to protect and preserve your wealth and not see it go down rather sharply. And that becomes the moment of panic where people begin to really rush into real assets as a haven. And that's when prices become unsustainable on the upside, but we're years away from that yet.
Yep. The pendulum doth swing. Here's the thing that shocked me. So that's why I put two exclamation points. I'm not a big exclamation point guy, so you know this is serious. I was shocked to read this, that as much tightly as I follow this, I didn't know this, that the wells themselves that we see here in 2024 are almost a third longer than they had been, which meant that in aggregate, lateral footage drilled each month since October was 70% higher than in 2018, and we're barely holding on to that output, and we're drilling things that are we drilled 70% more lateral feet.
No, I think that that's absolutely true. It's surprising to a lot of people, and it's one, you know, it's surprising for a couple reasons. First of all, I hear from a lot of folks that we've become so much more efficient, and to me that means that we're getting more out of the ground. And I guess it's getting it out of the ground per what? Per dollar spent, per day active, per whatever. You know, to me, I think of geological productivity as how much per unit of subsurface, per cubic meter of subsurface, how much oil are you getting out, you know, for a 10,000 foot lateral well that accesses 10,000 feet of the wellbore. But a lot of people quote, you know, per rig. And yeah, that's true. The rigs have become a lot more efficient because we're drilling them quicker and we're drilling them longer. Right. So each rig, if you look at the sort of, if you think about kind of the chain reaction, you have rigs, rigs drill wells, wells have lateral length has accesses reservoir, right? So your rig count has come way down. Your productivity of the rig count has gone way up in terms of lateral foot access per rig day, I guess, right? What a cumbersome metric that is. But I think you get the intuition. So that's true. If you had lots and lots and lots of undrilled acreage and your bottleneck was rigs, then increasing that metric would lead to a production bump because that would be the thing that was holding you back. But it's not. The thing that's holding you back is the fact that there's no good geological locations left. And so what that means, and that's kind of actually what you're seeing, if your rigs then become super productive, you can do so much more with a single rig. What does that mean? It means your rig count goes down because you don't have anything to do with those other rigs, right? It doesn't grow the way you would expect it to. And that's what we've seen. And that's why your utilizations on the rigs are low because there's just nothing to get after. And you made each rig quite productive.
Well, and then we see initial production per lateral foot. It's clearly trending down.
Oh, so it's clearly trending down.
We are drilling more faster and getting less out, and that's the depletion paradox, which was covered in your prior quarterly report. Everybody should read that, because paradoxically, we'll do more and more and get less and less, right? It'll mirror the 70s under Nixon.
I think that's exactly right. The paradox comes from the fact that production rolls over when there's still lots of reserve left in the ground. Everyone, I think, in their mind has this idea that production will keep growing until you run out of oil and then it kind of crashes to zero. It doesn't. It stops growing actually much earlier than that. And that's the paradox. And even the industry doesn't really get it, in the sense that, like, I was in a room full of oil and gas veterans and everyone said the same thing to me. They're like, I get what you're saying, but if you raise the price, I'm going to have more money that I can drill less good acres and I can still make couple bucks doing that, and I'll be able to grow production. And so if I can do it, everyone can do it. That's all true. That happened, but it wasn't able to increase the aggregate level of flow rates from these basins. That was true in the 70s. That's been true in all the shale basins to date, every single one except the Permian. It's not, you know, it's not because you can't make money drilling. It's just that you get less productive, and your initial, the super high declines from your high volume wells, you can't stack enough low volume wells on top of new ones on top of it to overcome that.
Well, and this is exactly what you pointed out in the report, which is that the more, obviously, I mean, the more wells you have, the more decline you have off of those wells. So the more you have to drill to offset that decline. And that as of now, it turns out the decline rate, quote, has not changed. The burden has grown heavier. More than a half a million barrels a month vanish before the first new well comes online. Twice the toll of 2018. So we have to run twice as fast as 2018 just to stay in place at these levels, right? So
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right. And it's funny because as I'm looking at these numbers, you know, perhaps the Exxon guy is right, because we kind of always thought about a 4 or 5% base decline rate on a global basis. But if really, let's say, you know, you're at 5% decline on conventional oil, and now you're at, you know, closer to, you know, what, 20-30% declines on the base on shale, and shale's now become 15% of the world. I mean, that number probably is higher. Is it as high as 15? I could do the arithmetic, but I guess in retrospect, it probably is, I would say, at least 200 basis points higher than it had been before because of that.
Well, it depends if we're talking crude plus condensate or the all liquids thing. So
yep.
I like to think of it as crude. So bottom line summary is, this is what your model is churning out right now for the Permian, right? Yep. And by the way, as we mentioned, all the other shales are already kind of in decline.
Yep.
And this looks a lot like what the EIA has put forward, too, just in terms of, like, it doesn't go away. But, man, we're not getting more out of the ground. And as goes the Permian, so goes the entirety of the U.S. production, in the sense that it's been holding up the declines from the other fields. They're all in decline at this point in time. Everyone I've looked at. Is that true?
That is true. That is okay. True.
I feel like this is just so underappreciated. It's ridiculous.
Nobody
at this
cares.
Point.
Nobody cares about oil and gas and energy at all. It hit a low of 1.8 in COVID when you weren't moving anyone around the planet and oil was spilling out over the tops of the tanks. Hit 1.8. You're at 2.3 today, waiting in the S&P. Okay, a single ounce can buy 60 barrels of oil. I have to find out what you can do with 60 barrels of oil in terms of, like, how far that's going to take you. I need some kind to put this in people's perspectives, right, to get it in the right mindset. This is as unloved an asset class as we have seen. You are 7 standard deviations away from normal, at least on that one metric. Things start blowing up when you're like at 3 standard deviations. Banks fail and collapse and stuff like that. When you have a day that's like 3.5, you're at 7. It's almost unheard of. This is a out of favor asset class on steroids. It is so unloved because everybody thinks, just like gold in 1999, it is a barbarous relic of the past. It used to have a use. It has no use going forward. It is simply untrue. It still is how this world gets around. It's not going anywhere, and we have not put a nickel into it in quite some time. I'll show you how mispriced this market is. Okay, oil bears, people are only interested in playing it on the short side and from a negative perspective. Oil bears will tell me all the time that it doesn't matter if the shales roll over because we have this huge offshore drilling boom now that's just going to accelerate from here, and we're going to get as much as we need in offshore Brazil, Guyana, Namibia, Angola. I say, okay, that's interesting. Like, so how are you playing it or whatever? And they don't really tell me. And you say, you know, if you really think that and you're a little bit worried or just want to hedge or double down, I don't even know what it would be, whether it's a Texas hedge or a proper hedge, you can go out and buy those drill ships that are apparently going to backstop this boom for effectively the scrap value of the steel on the board them. You know, they're 10 cents on the dollar replacement cost. If you think about what you could do with human ingenuity to add as much value as possible to a piece of steel, it's probably building a 7th generation semi-submersible drill ship. And you are near, on a replacement cost basis, you're getting down to like scrap values, okay? 10 cents on the dollar replacement cost. These things are being given away. This is allegedly what will be powering the entire boom going forward in the oil and gas industry that will be so prolific that it will overwhelm demand and cause prices to fall. Like, this market doesn't make any sense. These things are not logically cohesive anymore. That happens when people just walk away from it. They don't even think about the industry. They're not making sense. And that's where you are today. So there's huge opportunities, unbelievable, both in terms of taking a directional view on crude, as well as some mispriced assets like those offshore drill ships that I referenced a minute ago. And it's not dissimilar from gold in the late 90s. It's not dissimilar from uranium in 2018. And I think people will be very, very happy if they have at least some exposure in their portfolios to something that is really outside of the mainstream and outside of the carry trade.
Understood. And I really want to get your perspective on this, because this just came out yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. Trump wants more natural gas exports and lower energy prices. It's going to be tricky, they opine, right in the headline. Because look what they put right in here. Major gas basins are growing old. Mm-hmm. They put it right in there. And I thought this was astonishing. that they said, well, you know, these things are kind of growing old. You know what we're going to do? They said, oh, that's easy. We're going to need output from the Haynesville to increase basically by another third. So they need that to 1.3x its current output. And 40% of new LNG demand is going to the rest of Permian, and the other basins are going to fill the rest. Like, that's what they're going with here.
That's what
the Haynesville is going to 1.3x its output, and the others are going to fill in the gap somehow.
Yep. No, listen, and you know, I actually like Benoit Morin, who wrote that story. He's one of the only guys that stuck with the oil beat throughout the dog days here, and he has a pretty good handle on some of the technical sides of things. I've spoken to him a few times.
I'm not faulting him at all, but the analyst who said, oh yeah, who he's quoting here, who said,
the
article's good. Actually,
I agree with that, but if you read between the lines, what he's saying is that the problem with being able to increase exports is that the fields are getting really, really old. And you know, those analysts that think that that's going to happen, I mean, that is what has to happen to get the numbers to balance. I just don't think it's possible. I guess I'm feeling kind today. I'm looking only on the bright side of people's articles. But no, listen, that's exactly it. If you talk to anybody in the midstream business, in the AI power business, in the LNG business, they'll all tell you the same thing. The one thing they don't worry about is where they're going to source the gas. That's what they all tell you. The one thing they don't worry about is where they're going to source the gas. They worry about where they're going to source the power, you know, to have the turbines,
yeah,
but not the gas. And that's incorrect. And that people are going to pay a big price for that.
So let's close up then with natural gas, because, by the way, full disclosure, I invest in natural gas and oil and all that. But today, even though it looks like it's the same price as back there in 2017, inflation adjusted, it's way down. It would be as if gas was $4.67. Maybe we'd get more out of the ground. We know electricity costs are like, woo, you know, heading through the roof. We know that the whole world is saying, wow, we're going to use natural gas for electricity production, which the U.S. here is going to put in 90 gigawatts of gas-fired power plants. That's fine. Mostly because of the data center thing. That's fine. We're going to export more and more. These are all coming online, right? So by 2027, we need another, I don't know, another 12 billion cubic feet per day just to export, just to feed those things. That's
2027,
fine.
2027, by the way, is like 13, 14 months away.
It's coming in.
It is coming
in. And meanwhile,
in
the EIA is over here going, here's our forecast for its marketed dry natural gas production. Like, how do you put these two charts? This is in the EIA. This is in the EIA. They're the same outfit, and nobody's ringing any alarm bells here, and I'm just confused by that.
See, Chris, this is like, it's all a big game. They're giving you little clues here and there that it's not all going to work. And yet you can buy this stuff as though it's going out of business. So every once in a while, like the joke that the economists say, or two economists look at each other and say, is that a $20 bill? No, it couldn't be. It would have been picked up by now. Sometimes it's just a $20 bill, and all you got to do is bend over and pick it up. And I think that the entire resource complex is going to be that kind of an investment for the next decade or so. I think that the energy side, for right now, you know, typically in resource bull markets, different areas show leadership and then, you know, cycle out, and they all tend to go up, right? So you don't have to be too subtle into where you are. Anywhere kind of works, as long as it hasn't had a capital boom behind it or capex boom behind it. But parts of the market will do better than others. Gold has done much better than oil in the last couple of years. I think it's oil's turn probably coming up here pretty soon. Doesn't mean gold does badly, but oil probably is going to catch up. Gas as well. I mean, natural gas in the United States is the cheapest molecule of energy on the planet. And we have a lot of demand coming to try to soak up that gas. Now, we've had a lot of demand. It hasn't soaked it up in the past, but that's because supply's grown and grown and grown. But you look at the supply numbers, they haven't done anything. They haven't done anything in like 3 years, you know? So it's just a very, very good story. It's very tight markets, and I'm growing tired of my voice is growing hoarse from screaming it from the rooftops, but yeah. Nobody cares other than you, Chris, so. Kudos.
I care a lot. Shell cares. They just noticed that global demand for LNG is going to outstrip supply about early 2030s, just because, you know, you have to build these big giant plants, are capital intensive, and nobody cares. So it's easy to see sort of these shortfalls are about to come, and I think it's about as easy a setup and layup. Listen, as I mentioned, I put my savings into gold started in 2001. and I went pretty heavy. I'm kind of an irresponsible guy that way. Silver too. Because I could see the setup for that. It was just really hated, and I couldn't understand why it was hated, given all sorts of things. History, the fact that it was obvious we were going to print more, etc. This seems about as easy a layup as I can imagine, too. We're building huge demand for oil and gas, and we're not building the supply needed for that.
Yep.
It's kind of like...
That's how I see it too. Okay, and assets over time, they're young, they come online. Usually, what happens is prices are high, it creates an exploration boom and a drilling boom, and new young assets come to the fore. And because it takes so long from that first moment of panic and investment and high prices to when the supply comes online, it tends to bring on too much capital in the middle and too much supply, and then prices collapse. And people say, well, you know, that was foolish. You can't make much money when oil's at 40. You say, no, well, we thought it was going to be 90. You know, even if you look at all the shale guys, were they too overly exuberant? Yeah, probably. But, I mean, they had from 2010 to 2014, oil averaged $100 with unbelievably low volatility. And then it went to 27. So, yeah, the projects didn't really earn a particularly good rate of return if you invested for 100 and you got 27. But it hadn't been 27 for a long time. You know, it stayed at 100. So these things are cyclical. They're massively cyclical. Money pours back out and the market slowly ratchets tighter and tighter and tighter until eventually it tips back into deficit and off you go. So that's the cycle. That's the model. We're certainly underinvested. There's no two ways about that. Even the IEA admits that you're not investing enough now to replace depletion. The narrative that's emerged is that EVs are going to take over the world and eat everyone's lunch in the oil markets, but it's not happening because they're not particularly energy efficient. Hybrids work. Those will go forward. They still consume gasoline, though. So, you know, the numbers are still growing very robustly. And you're in a tight spot. So everyone hates it. Nobody likes it. Can't get anyone to agree. Everyone is convinced that AI is just going to continue to dominate the world, even though if that is true, that precipitates its own bull market in energy because it is the most energy intensive undertaking we've ever really tried to do. You know, so I think all roads lead to higher oil prices, higher gas prices. We need to normalize these ratios, bring them back into line, attract the capital back in. Does it happen now or in 6 months from now? I don't know. By 2030, I think you'll be awfully happy that you have some allocation and exposure into this industry.
Well, excellent. And so we've been talking with Adam Rosentrag, Gehring and Rosentrag. Everybody should read this. The next inflationary surge is about to begin, August 25th report. You can find that at gorosen.com. That's G-O-R-O-Z-E-N.com. And Adam, can you please tell people about the mutual fund you run?
Yeah, sure. We run a 40 Act mutual fund here in the States and a UCITS fund for offshore investors. And all the information's on our website. We have two share classes, very low minimums for retail investment. And we're, you know, widely available and low cost. So please go have a look.
Well, and they've been doing very well lately. So I've been tracking that. Obviously, past performance, no indication of future success, all that. But yeah, it's clearly you've been doing some things right in there. So with that, Adam, thank you so much for your time again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.